A new video shows the racist bullying, assault, and arrest of Sandra Bland by Texas State Trooper Brian Encinia, and the island nation of Cuba scores a victory against its racist bullying neighbor to its north. All that and more coming up next. Welcome to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition for July 23rd, 2015 on 89.3 WPFW, your Pacifica listener-powered station for jazz and justice in the nation's capital. On the ground and onthegroundshow.org are devoted to coverage of social justice activists and activism here in the DMV, the nation, and around our world. I'm Esther Rivera. I'm here to make our show's contribution to the week-long emergency fund drive. For today's show, we're making the links between Cuba and the U.S. Black Lives Matter movement. I'm offering as a thank you gift Gerald Horn's groundbreaking book, Race to Revolution, the United States and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. In Race to Revolution, Horn draws a direct link between the black experiences in two very different countries and follows that connection through changing periods of resistance and revolutionary upheaval. You get that book for only $50, only a $50 donation, and that can be yours as a thank you gift. Or if you sign up to become a sustaining member at only $10 a month, we can also send you the book. I also have the award-winning documentary Citizen Coke, all about the influence of the billionaire Koch brothers and how Wisconsin governor and now presidential candidate Scott Walker is in their pocket. So just in time for the sickeningly early start of the 2016 political season. I'm already tired of it. So author and activist Gerald Horn will join us a little later in the show, and we'll also be speaking with longtime activist and cultural heritage specialist James Early, who has spent decades involved in the struggles of African descendants in the Caribbean and Latin America. So you can get me started by calling 202-588-9739, 202-588-9739, or pledge right online at wpfw.org. Click the donate button and make sure you select Thursday's Community Watch and Comment on the drop-down menu. So as always, we have a lot for you in this less than an hour, and we'll get started with our headlines. The attorney for Sandra Bland's family told MSNBC last night that officials in Waller County, Texas, have asked to perform what would be a third autopsy on the body of Sandra Bland because the first one they performed was flawed. Attorney Cannon Lambert broke the news last night and expressed shock at the request. After retrieving Bland's body from Texas and having it transported to Chicago, the family had their own independent autopsy conducted and expect a report in coming weeks. Lambert said that they are not sending the body back to Texas, and he spoke on MSNBC last night.
3 days before she's to be put to rest, her funeral is scheduled on the 25th. This family has gone through the process of going down and bringing her back. And when they brought her back, they started planning for her home going. And now, today, a few moments ago, we get faced with a text saying, well, our first autopsy was not sufficient. We're going to need another one. It's very unusual, and it's really, really challenging for me to be able to say and appeal to her better angels and say, and to her family's better angels, and say, let's let this process take its course because we have to have faith that they're going to do what they're saying they're going to do. It's, you know, we've got requests out right now on, for records and so forth that haven't been met or addressed or responded to, and instead things are getting trickled out, and I don't know where they came from or when they were generated. I mean, the reality of it is that there are a whole host of things that are very unusual as to how they're playing out.
Lambert said that if they agree to a third autopsy, it will need to be done in Chicago. Sandra Bland's homegoing service is scheduled for Saturday in Chicago. The Apache Stronghold Caravan arrived in Washington, D.C. Tuesday, where it rallied at Capitol Hill to protest the construction of a copper mine on the territory of Oak Flat near Phoenix, which is considered sacred lands by indigenous groups. Several dozen members of the Apache and Navajo tribes Local activists and supporters joined the demonstration. The Apache caravan left Arizona on July 5th and traveled 2,000 miles here to Washington, D.C., where they held their mass rally. The activists are specifically protesting the Oak Flat Land Exchange bill that was approved by Congress, proposed by Arizona Senator John McCain in the framework of the National Defense Authorization Act. It hands over Oak Flat to Resolution Copper, a joint venture owned by Rio Tinto and BHP Billiton. One Apache tribe member told RT that he blamed Senator John McCain for the giveaway. He said, "John McCain is a traitor. He lies, he's a cheat, and he is stealing from America. He stole your land." As the Cuban embassy reopened here in D.C. after 54 years, D.C. activists are in Cuba, participating in the annual caravan for Cuba sponsored by Pastors for Peace. Director Gail Walker told Telesur from Cuba that opening the embassy is a good step, but the economic blockade against the island must also be lifted.
We have really been working for this moment where there would be this opportunity for our two nations to work toward normal relations. We're not quite there, but we're certainly on the path. And we felt that the work that we've been doing since 1992 to really put the voice of the people of the United States in particular out there on this issue was very critical. We felt that this year was especially important given the fact that there has been this opening, which we applaud, created by both Presidents Barack Obama and President Raul Castro. However, we know that the economic blockade is still intact and that the only way that that will finally get dissolved and done away with is by our continued vigilance and persistence to continue to challenge the travel ban and the blockade by delivering our humanitarian aid.
And those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, we'll be joined by Professor Gerald Horn as well as by activist and culture and heritage specialist James Early. Stay with us and don't delay. Call 202-588-0893 to support On the Ground and support WPFW. That was the crowd at the reopening on Monday of the Cuban embassy right on 16th Street in Northwest here in D.C. on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. So as the Cuban embassy reopened after being closed for 54 years, just this week we have a new video that assaults us with the violence and violation of another black person's human rights. And at the same time, I think these videos bless us with additional truth about that violence and resistance that we can see with our own eyes. Certainly on this show, we've covered enough to make the quick link for everyone between these two separate incidents. On the one hand, there is the centuries-long state violence and oppression of African Americans in this country, manifested most recently by this racist bullying, assault, and arrest of Sandra Bland by Brian Encinia, a Texas state trooper. And we also see her resistance to it. And then 3 days later, it was claimed that Bland committed suicide in her jail cell. On the other hand, there's this century-long state violence and oppression of the people of Cuba by the United States in probably its closest act of colonialism and empire, closest to the empire here itself. And so when we listen to the speech by given by Cuban Foreign Affairs Minister Bruno Rodriguez Paria, he talks about he gave this talk at the reopening of the embassy, and he talked about it being a victory for the resistance of the Cuban people. more than 400 years here, and we are in this daily dance of how we as individuals or as nations of African people will navigate, these attempts to subjugate us or humiliate us. So those are some of my thoughts, and with me today to unpack and sort out these ideas and thoughts of what seems like a watershed week, but quite frankly, every week seems like that to me, a watershed week, because something new is happening that's so significant and so big and huge. I have two guests, the prolific author and activist Gerald Horn, a frequent commentator here on this show and across the Pacifica Network, and also longtime activist on issues related to Afro descendants in the Caribbean and Latin America, Gerald James Early. He's former director of cultural heritage policy at the Smithsonian Institution Center for Folk Life and Heritage, Cultural Heritage. Good morning, Gerald.
Good morning.
And good morning, James.
Good morning.
So thank you, both of you, for joining me this morning. So, James, let's start with you. I think you were at the reopening at the embassy on Monday. This is the same, I believe it's the same grand building where near Anna's Morgan, where that served as the intersection for decades after the embassy was closed. So what are your reflections on that day and this historic week?
I was indeed there, and it was an extraordinary moment in which the history of the Cuban Revolution starting in 1959 was really expressed in very iconic ways in the raising of the flag, which symbolizes Cuba's full independence, self-determination, and sovereignty. And I said to the Washington Post that we should be mindful when Fidel Castro was in that building in 1959, and when he said, "I come here under Operation Truth, bearing the weight of the Cuban Revolution." What the raising of this flag symbolizes is that Cuba has not only resisted imperial power that has made it very difficult for the internal developments of the socialist revolution, but Cuba is a signal post for the new independence of Latin America and the integration of the Caribbean and what they call their second independence of self-determination. So it is a very, it was a very thrilling and positive moment of the resistance and the transformation of the Cuban people and their political stewards, their political representatives. On the other hand, it was also quite an astounding moment for us in the U.S. and a fresh opportunity for both the liberal and progressive and left socialist-oriented communities in the United States to re-enter the protocols of nations in Latin America and the Caribbean, because we, as a country, have been so isolated by the great majority of the nations of the Caribbean and Latin America, principally around the fact that we would not recognize their support of Cuba's right to self-determination.
Gerald, I wanted to, I actually have a clip of a portion of Perilla's remarks made that day, the foreign minister who spoke that day. But before I go to that, I wanted to get your kind of opening comments on the reopening of the embassy, Gerald.
Well, I think that it's not necessarily coincidental that the tragic death of Sandra Bland takes place at the same time as this heroic, exhilarating moment of the step towards normalizing relations between Cuba and the United States. I say that because in recent months, as your comments suggest, we've been bombarded with video of black people in particular being killed, not least by U.S. police authorities. And I think it's necessary to step back for a second and ask why this is taking place, or why these floods of images that represent state slaughter. And I think it has something to do with the fact that over the last 60 to 70 years, we people of African descent, as we were able to push back against Jim Crow and get a kind of citizenship, we let our international connections lapse. And with that pressure from the international community receding, we now see this tidal wave of slaughter by the state authorities. And the raising of the flag at the Cuban embassy just recently, I think, should remind us that we should jump that strategy that led us to this tragic moment, There are those who suggest that the United States somehow dominates an international arena, but I think that'll come as a surprise to UN Ambassador Samantha Power, who represents Washington. Just one data point amongst many, the United States has not been able to get the United Nations to sign on to a resolution to dislodge the regime in Damascus, amongst many defeats that Washington has suffered. And certainly those who have a bone to pick with Uncle Sam would welcome a relationship with Black Americans. And after talking to people in the international community, they're a bit puzzled and baffled and befuddled, as am I, about our community's unwillingness or inability to recognize that this is the sleeping giant, that is to say, reconnecting with the international community.
Okay. You know, actually, I mentioned, I think, in the intro to the show how the Pastors for Peace caravan is in Cuba right now, and we played a clip by Gail Walker, director of IFCO, that caravan effort. And I actually have another clip by her where she talks about, touches on connecting these two issues of Cuba and human rights here in the U.S.
There is still that misinformation campaign that kind of gets, waved out there and dangled out there that we have to contend with. So the positive is that Cuba is in the news. It's being, focused in on. The messages continue to be somewhat worrisome. For example, I think that there's really, an effort to kind of, talk about human rights in Cuba. But this is absent the discussion about what human rights means in the United States, the fact or the lack thereof, the fact that Black and brown men are being shot with impunity on the streets by, law enforcement on a regular basis with no kind of redress or, is that's a human rights abuse. The fact that you have working families that are out and indeed working to provide for their families but can't provide a roof over their heads, can't provide enough food on the table, still need to visit shelters in order to get enough food to feed their families. And on, there are examples, I think, of human rights abuses that are very prevalent in the United States, but that don't get focused on. Yet there's this effort to kind of dangle out there that Cuba has this, horrific record in that regard.
So again, that was Gail Walker. She's actually speaking from Cuba to Telesur earlier this week. She's director of the Pastors for Peace caravan, the IFCO caravan that regularly has been supplying humanitarian aid to Cuba. One of the things that was said on Monday, and that we've already said on this show, is about how the blockade is still in effect. This economic blockade that is having a tremendous economic impact on the island. And so, James, I wanted to ask you about what has to happen, remind us of what has to happen to lift that blockade, and how likely is that to happen?
Well, the blockade is still the principal egregious imposition of U.S. empire against Cuba, and it's going to be protracted. It is being predicted now that because the blockade is a congressional authority, the removal of that congressional authority will not take place over the next 18 months of the administration of Barack Obama. That is not to say that under a new administration of whoever it is in the White House, that it will immediately take place. I think the pressure coming from the self-determination of the Cubans, which has fully integrated them into Latin America and the Caribbean under the new community of Latin American and Caribbean nations, the rapprochement of the European Union, including the reactionary government of Spain, is sending in many of its ministers to talk to Cuba about reestablishing normal relations with them. The South-South relations, in which Cuba is very positively implicated vis-a-vis Brazil, which has put over $1 billion reais into the new port in Mariel, a deep water port which will connect to Nicaragua, the new canal in Nicaragua, if that is finished. All of these things argue that the United States is being left further and further behind in terms of economic relations with Cuba. And one of the reflections of that is that moderate, pragmatic Republicans and many liberals, the Chamber of Commerce, and many large internet companies have already stepped in to talk to the Cubans. So de facto, slowly by slowly, this economic embargo will dissolve and probably will be dissolved in very qualitative ways somewhat long before a formal decree from Congress actually removes it.
So there is no individual act that President Obama can take. I mean, I guess I understand that President Clinton signed away the ability for the president to reverse this on his own or her own.
The Clinton administration conciliated the Helms-Burton Act, the racist representative from the state of South Carolina, if I recall correctly, the Helms-Burton Act, which put this this congressional decree into force. So it is only the Congress that can de facto legally remove the formal requirements of the embargo. But the fact of the matter of politics, that is the negotiation of real power and exchange, particularly in the economic arena at the global and regional level, is already eating away at that embargo. A bank in Pompano, Florida, just a few days ago, signed an agreement with the Cuban government to do banking. The State Department, the Treasury Department, had to give authority for that. The fact that airlines, not just charters, but major airline companies now are flying in and out of Cuba, not just to Havana, but to other points. All of these are small incremental steps that are mounting and that will accumulate more and more over time and force the effectiveness of this embargo to be lowered to a significant degree.
Okay.
So that's what's the sort of the context of the embargo.
Okay. I think that I would like to play the remarks from the Cuban foreign minister made on at the opening this week. And but before I do that, I want to remind our listeners that this is WPFW's emergency mini drive, and you can call 202-588-9739 to support your listener-powered station right here in D.C., and you can also go to WPFW.org and select the Thursday edition of Community Watch and Comment to pledge your support today. Again, we have as thank you gifts Gerald Horn's Race the Revolution, and we also have the Citizen Coke documentary, and the operators can tell you all about those thank you gifts. And let's go to the remarks made by the Cuban foreign minister on Monday.
La bandera de la estrella solitaria que encarna la generosa sangre derramada.
Flying once again in this place is the Lone Star flag, which embodies the generous blood that was shed, the sacrifices made and the struggle waged for more than 100 years by our people for their national independence and full determination, facing the most serious challenges and risks. Today we pay homage to all those who die in its defense and renewed the commitment of the present generations with absolute confidence on the generations to come to serve it with honor. We evoke the memory of José Martí, who was fully devoted to the struggle for the freedom of Cuba and was able to get a thorough knowledge of the United States. In his work entitled North American Scenes, he made a vivid description of the great nation to the north and extolled its virtues. He also bequeathed to us the warning against its excessive craving for domination, which was confirmed by a long history of disagreements. We've been able to make it through this date thanks to the firm and wise leadership of Fidel Castro Ruz, the historic leader of the Cuban Revolution, whose ideas we will always revere with almost glory. We now recall his presence in this city in April of 1959 with the purpose of promoting fair bilateral relations. The purposes that brought him to this country on such an early time are the same that have been pursued throughout these decades and coincide exactly with the ones that we pursue today. Many in this room, politicians, journalists, outstanding personalities in the fields of arts or sciences, students or American social activists, have been able to treasure unlimited hours of enriching talks with the commander, which allowed them to get a better understanding of our reasons, goals, and decisions. This ceremony has been possible thanks to the free and unshakable will, unity, sacrifice, selflessness, heroic resistance, and work of our people, and also the strength of the Cuban nation and its culture. Several generations of the revolutionary diplomacy have converged in this effort and offer their martyrs. The example and vibrant speech of Raúl Roa, the Chancellor of Dignity, have continued to inspire Cuba's foreign policy and will remain forever in the memory of the younger generations and future diplomats.
So we hear in the foreign minister's remarks talking about the heroic resistance of the Cuban people. And Gerald, you know, in your book, Race to Revolution, you outline the many ways that Africans in this country and in Cuba have had a relationship in terms of having our struggles linked and supporting each other's struggles. You know, it's a tremendous and fascinating, you know, history and story. And I wonder if you can give some highlights as they pertain to the current Black Lives Matter movement.
Well, what comes to mind immediately is the 19th century and the fact that the great abolitionists Frederick Douglass and Martin Delaney were in strict solidarity with Cubans then laboring under slavery at that particular moment. And of course, we also know that one of the reasons there are so many people of African descent in Cuba is because the maniacal energy of U.S. slave traders and slave dealers, who particularly in the 19th century sailed up the Congo River, snatching and manacling every African in sight and then dragging them across the Atlantic to Cuba, and of course some of them being able to slip into Florida and the Gulf of Mexico states such as Alabama and Louisiana, and even Texas in particular, who, by the way, their flag, the Lone Star flag, resembles that of Cuba. I think that with regard to the Black Lives Matter movement, which really has been doing yeoman service in recent weeks and months, particularly with the defacing of these Confederate monuments that pockmarked the landscape throughout the United States of America, they'll be meeting in Cleveland rather shortly in order to put more flesh on the bones and in order to solidify their movement. And I hope and dare say that at that meeting in Cleveland, there will be initiatives that will involve not only reaching out to Cuba, but reaching out to our friends in the Caribbean, reaching out to our friends in Africa at the African Union, particularly, that is appropriate to mention, on the verge of President Obama heading to Addis Ababa, where he will be meeting with leaders of the African Union. It seems to me that we should be right there with him, of course, presenting a different picture than that which he paints.
Okay. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm your host, Esther Avarum, and I'm in conversation with Gerald Horn and James Early. We will continue our conversation after this break, but I want to take this opportunity to urge you again to call 202-588-9739 to support us during the emergency drive. We're offering Race to Revolution, Gerald Horn's groundbreaking book about the history of Cuba and also its relationship to United States and African Americans, and also the documentary Citizen Coke, all about those billionaire Koch brothers and their stranglehold on our electoral process, our democracy, on the presidential candidate, Scott Walker. And if you call 202-588-9739, you can get those. It's just $50 each. You can get them both for, actually, the first five people or seven people can get both for $75, but after that, you can get each for $50. And you can also go to wpfw.org to also make your pledge. And we're going to go to a little break right now, but when we come back, we'll continue our discussion. If I can get some callers making their pledge, I can try to go to the phone lines and take your calls as well. Stay with us.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition for July 23rd, 2015 on 89.3 WPFW, Euro Pacifica, listener-powered station for jazz and justice in the nation's capital, on the ground, and onthegroundshow.org are devoted to coverage of social justice activists and activism here in the DMV, the nation, and around our world. I'm Esther Verum, and like I said before, we're here to make our show's contribution to the week-long emergency fund drive for today's special show. We're making the links between Cuba and the U.S. Black Lives Matter movement. I'm offering as a thank you gift Gerald Horn's groundbreaking book, Race to Revolution, the United States and Cuba During Slavery and Jim Crow. In Race to Revolution, Horn draws a direct link between the black experiences in two very different countries and follows that connection through changing periods of resistance and revolutionary upheaval. You get that book for only a $50 donation, or if you sign up to become a sustaining member at only $10 a month. I also have the award-winning documentary Citizen Coke, all about the influence of the billionaire Koch brothers and how Wisconsin governor and now presidential candidate Scott Walker is in their pocket. So we have that just in time for this early start of the 2016 political season. So author and activist Gerald Horn is with me, and also on the line is James Early, a longtime activist and cultural heritage specialist who has spent decades involved in the struggles of African descendants in the Caribbean and in Latin America. And I am waiting for a pledge, right? But you can pledge by calling 202-588-9739 and also go online to wpfw.org to make a pledge. And I think we do have a caller, but before we go to the caller, I want to ask a follow-up Gerald's point about the type of actions that we can take to appeal to the United Nations, to appeal to the international community, to link our struggle domestically to theirs, not only in Cuba, but around the world. And we've talked about the United Nations petition in the past, but what are some of the other ways? Is the United Nations the only avenue that we can pursue at this point?
Well, if you're asking me, the answer is no. I mean, if you talk about the Sandra Bland case, what I find striking about it is the tidal wave of publicity it's received in the international media. That is to say, from RT in Moscow and France 24 in Paris and Press TV in Tehran. I think that that's what's really helped to give this case so much momentum. And so I would hope that at the Black Lives Matter meeting upcoming in Cleveland, that the international press would be well represented. That is to say that this global initiative in many ways is just mimicking what we've been doing for hundreds of years. But right. As noted, in recent decades, we've allowed that muscle to atrophy, as apparently some of us have been seduced by the idea that we had attained full U.S. citizenship. But the police are trying to remind us otherwise. So what I'm suggesting is that we've just returned to what brought us to this point, which not only precedes the founding of the United Nations in 1945, but also involves outreach, particularly in the press, which goes back to the late 18th century.
In addition to Gerald's very important point about the role of the press or mass media, which has been picking up very consistently and increasingly in depth on the murderous attacks of the use of official violence on the part of the police, tied into military equipment, and of course tied into elected city councils and state and congressional representatives who have brought forth the kind of legislation and endorsed the imposition of this legislation, which has led to the swelling of the jails and the prisons with black and brown people, increasingly women, and with the increase of this official violence, we must also make contact to the Afro-descent civil society movements, particularly within the American hemisphere. I get calls all the time from Telesur, from Rebellion in Cuba, and other media outlets looking at the situation here in the U.S. And the importance of making connection to Afro-descendant citizens in these countries, and including in Cuba, is that characteristically when you walk through this hemisphere, the prisons and the jails are filled with black people and indigenous people. It is a history of the use of official violence to protect the property of the new system in the so-called new world of capitalism, in which black people were the mental and physical labor, and we were the property, quote-unquote, that had to be protected. And that legacy, unfortunately, sadly, is still very reflective throughout this hemisphere. In the case of Cuba in particular, notwithstanding the extraordinary development, social developments of its socialist revolution, and what has redounded to Afro-Cubans and Mestizo-Cubans in a very positive way in access to free education and health care and employment, Cubans themselves have put on the docket that there is a continuous struggle against racism in the context of their Cuban socialism. That is expressed in two main civil society organizations among Cubans. One is the Jose Aponte Committee Against Racism, which is developed by the Union of Artists and Writers in Cuba, which is a parastatal of leftists and progressives and astounding extraordinary intellectuals and artists. And the other is the Cuban chapter of the Regional Articulation of Afro-Descendants in Latin America and the Caribbean, self-avowed left Afro-descendants who are looking at trans-regional issues and connecting the issues against racism towards the issue of full citizenship in the context of the new community of Latin American and Caribbean nations, in the context of the ALBA countries, the alternative Bolivarian revolutionary countries that Hugo Chavez pioneered, and then UNASUR, the Union of South American Nations, which is also a pioneering process of the Venezuelans to Hugo Chavez, bringing together Latin American nations. So we've got to make contact at the citizen level as well and meet the challenge of learning Spanish so that we can read and communicate with those Afro-descended citizens.
Okay. We actually have a caller. You can also call in. You can also pledge. I hope that you call, you pledge, then call in to 202-588-0893 to join the discussion, 588-9739 to make your pledge. And I want to thank a listener. I want to thank Anonymous from D.C., who is a sustainer, and that is a smart way to become a member. For as little as $10 a month, you can be a member of the station, and we just deduct that just the way you pay your gym membership or a lot of other bills. We just deduct that amount that you decide each month. And so I want to thank Anonymous from DC. You can join DC. I want to hear from Maryland and Virginia. I usually get a lot of calls from Arlington, Alexandria, and, you know, in Maryland, from Bowie, Suitland, Silver Spring, College Park, Hyattsville. I know you're listening, so I need you to step up and join Anonymous from D.C. and be in the house with us today. So let me go to our first caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Jay from D.C.
I'm sorry?
Jay from D.C.
Good morning.
Hey, I have a challenge to the Black Lives Matter and other so-called progressive activist movement. Using only open source software, we should create a website that we can control where you can use Ruby on Rails, post this back in, and host it in Sweden or some other non-US ISP where it's secure. And we post all the information on all of these police and other people who are brutalizing us. Get all the intelligence we want, pictures, names, their families, their addresses, everything. Post it publicly. We then create the organizational capacity to get people to do first very simple things, like tag their stuff, BLM, Black Lives Matter, tag their cars, tag their houses, tag everything to let them know we know who you are, we know where you live, and you're going to start to feel some pressure. Then what we ultimately want to do is create the organizational capacity to say, look, we give you 6 months a year, you prosecute this person, or we're going to take matters in our own hands. And ultimately, we need to put out a bounty on these police and other people who kill us, because they will continue to kill us as long as we allow them to kill us. And asking the system to change itself is impotent. You never ask your oppressor to stop waging war against you. You wage war against them to win. You don't wage war against them to be neutral. You wage war against them to win. So that's a quick, simple thing to do. You don't need to go to the UN. You can still go to the UN, but that's not going to happen because the UN can't do anything. They don't. We have to have the army. And if we're not willing to do this, then you're going to continue to have these shows, because they have shown they will continue to kill us unless we start to do the same to them. Thank you.
Okay. Well, you know, it's very interesting because I've listened to a number of people talk about having an army, and we don't have an army. You know, we don't have an army, and we have to use the avenues available to us. And as far as the internet and the computer skills and the, you know, creating the website, I think this caller has the skills to actually do that. So sometimes we all have to think about what we all can do, how we all can contribute, and what we all can do actively, and when that's being an activist and not just a critic. You know, we can, I think you have those skills to set up that type of website. So maybe that can be your contribution to the movement. And maybe some of the people who you're criticizing, they don't have those skills. So sometimes we have to just pitch in, and we have to do what we can and connect with people and work collectively and not just criticize. So 202-588-9739 is the pledge line. And I hope that some people are joining Anonymous, who made a sustaining pledge this morning. And I hope that people are calling 202-588-9739 or pledging online at wpfw.org. But I do have another caller. But before I go to the caller, I wanted to follow up with Gerald Horn and James Early about that, what we were discussing. And I'm glad, James, that you mentioned Telesur and these other, you know, media, because I wanted to know if this, the type of situation with Sandra Bland, her death, the death of Michael Brown, Eric Garner, all the things that we're going through in this country is covered, in Latin America and in the Caribbean, because we have access to RT, we have access to, you know, the French channel, the Chinese channel, even, you know, sometimes I can get a channel from South Africa, Ethiopia, but how about coverage in the Cuban media, also in other media in the Caribbean and Latin America?
Yes, these incidents of use of official violence and the assassination and murder daily of black men and women, especially young black men and women, are covered almost daily in Latin America. And in many instances, the motive force for this is to show the criminal nature of the U.S. government, and the disingenuousness of the U.S. government preaching to others about human rights as it violates basic human rights here in the United States. And, of course, that is a very strong suit of pressure to force the United States to consider not only how to try to obscure that, but to respond to the creative, transformative perspectives that these young black American men and women and Black Lives Matter have brought forth, and a new kind of horizontally integrated leadership. It's not about a vertical, single profile of leadership. And I think we must acknowledge that there are transforming dimensions of the leadership of these young black people that are not just petitioning, but forcing the system to be reflective of our democratic aspirations. However, one of the shortcomings of this coverage in Latin America in particular is that it has only a critical perspective looking towards the United States, and therein failing to look at perhaps the most egregious day-to-day killing of young black men and women in the entire hemisphere, way beyond any comparison with the United States, and that's in Brazil. For decades, young black men and women have been shot down like dogs in the street by police, by vigilante police. It's the largest Afro-descendant population in this hemisphere. Over 90 million black people, over half the official census, of Brazil. So we have to demand of this press coverage not only to be critical of human rights situation in the United States, but to be honest and responsive to the situation of the 150 million African descendants in Latin America.
Okay.
The Caribbean who are living in citizens, who are festering in jails and prisons.
Okay. So we actually have a couple more callers. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
Morning, my sister. Good morning, Dr. Horn, and good morning to your other guest.
James Early.
Yes. And it's a wonderful show. I can say demands of human rights and demands of respect for private property should not only be demanded of Cuba, it should be demanded everywhere. In Ethiopia, the genociders are killing people. Just before yesterday, they killed so many people, and they have confiscated private property, which they took over from the former government. And now, demand of human rights should not be selective. When demands of human rights are made selective, it loses its meaning and it makes the whole humanity bad. It looks bad on all humanity. And the United States should not be the first to demand human rights on Cuba while its own citizens, black citizens, are killed every other day. And when its president goes and shakes hands with genociders from Ethiopia, Rwanda, Congo, and Eritrea.
Okay. Okay. Thank you, Tesfa. Let me go to the next caller. Just say your first name and where you're calling from.
My first name is Jerry. I'm calling from Rome.
Good morning.
Good morning. And I would like to see a program done on the New World Order and America's role in structuring that throughout the world, and to take a look at the Aryan race, which is the white race, and their progenitor, where you can find in the book of 2 Kings, Chapter 5, and these are the people who confronted Jesus Christ in the temple. They were the money changers, and they have been here throughout history, creating havoc.
Okay, thank you. Do we have another caller? Okay, so we're getting close to the end of our show, so I want to make another appeal to our listeners to join Anonymous from D.C., who is a sustaining member, and you can call 202-588-9739, or you can, that's 202-588-9739, and you can become a member of the station. You can renew your membership. You can get a membership from someone else. You can share the information, music, culture that we provide here at WPFW with a larger community. Help us expand our community. I think they're stressing how terrestrial radio is facing many challenges, either in the not-for-profit realm or the commercial realm. And so we're right in that same boat. But we know that we are your station for jazz and justice here in the nation's capital. There's no other station with this type of reach all the way into Delaware, West Virginia, parts of Virginia, out to the Eastern Shore, where the people who are walking the halls of power here in the nation's capital will hear different voices, the people's voices, the people's power to raise our voices in this way. So again, 202-588-9739 or WPFW.org to pledge online. I'm speaking to Gerald Horn and James Early, and we are talking about the links between the historic event this week, the reopening of the Cuban embassy here in D.C. and its connection and Cuba's connection to the Black Lives Matter movement. And so I wanted to ask each of you if you had any closing thoughts or any ideas or that you didn't have a chance to express so far?
Gerald?
Well, just briefly, let me underscore what has just been said about the importance of this emergency fund drive. I hope that the folks within range of my voice are not taking WPFW for granted, and that they think that it is an eternity and does not face many challenges. Because, of course, it does face many challenges, and particularly if people fail to respond to this kind of emergency fund drive, I dare say that it would be a shame and a sin if somehow this station were to disappear from the airwaves, which I do not see happening, because I do know and I do have confidence that there are those who are listening who will pick up the phone and immediately call in to pledge, and I'm eagerly awaiting your call.
I join Gerald in that sentiment and in that action. WPFW is an extraordinary resource for us. It's always easy to complain about what we don't have, but it should be much easier for us simply to step forth and support what we do have. And it is clear what we have in WPFW by a simple comparison to any other media outlets, whether it's printed outlets. I include the Real News Network, of which I'm a board member, as along with Democracy Now!, along with the equivalents of people's opportunities to express themselves through WPFW. So please support the station. I would just conclude by saying that Black Lives Matters is a tag that is run around the world, and we see both in here in the United States, again, with this young black leadership of men and women, we see churches with signs of Black Lives Matter. Let's not take those things for granted. Let's acknowledge that despite challenges or differences that some may have with churches or other leadership formations here in the United States, people are responding to the leadership of the movement of Black Lives Matter, and we need to get in there and deal with the complex positive ways in which they are responding. And I would just stop by bringing people's attention to another place that Black Lives Matter in this hemisphere is the recent atrocity of murder in Buenaventura, Colombia. Colombia is the most complex black community in this hemisphere, with Afro-Colombians, Palenqueros, which speak a distinct African-derived language, and Raizales, all people of black skin, many of them still carrying their nation and tribal names pre-colonial times on the continent of Africa. Please call the State Department and pressure the State Department in responding to the need to protect and to force the Colombian government to add extra protection to the citizens in Colombia. Outside of Haiti, which is a nation, the situation in Colombia in the Civil War, the 50-year Civil War going on, is the most egregious, dangerous situation for black people, notwithstanding my earlier comments about Brazil.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I think that will have to do it for us today, but I have some people to thank. I want to thank Curtis from D.C. I want to thank another anonymous caller from D.C. I want to thank Lisa from Maryland. Maryland is in the house, and I only need like $50 to make my goal for the show. And I know that caller must, you're on your way to the phone right now to make that call for, so I can get that last $50. You know, you can pick up Race to Revolution, the United States and Cuba during slavery and Jim Crow. You can pick up Citizen Coke. And I know we're going to make our goal for sure. So 202-588-9739 is the number to call. And also you can go and pledge online at wpfw.org. I've been speaking with Gerald Horn, author and activist, frequent contributor across the Pacifica Network and on this show, and also James Early, longtime activist and cultural heritage specialist who has spent decades involved in the struggles of African descendants in Caribbean and Latin America. Thank you, James.
Thank you.
And thank you, Gerald.
Thank you.
So, that's it. I also want to thank my engineer, Mike Nasella, and thank you so much for listening and calling in and for supporting your station for Jazz and Justice. You can keep calling in and get a copy of Gerald Horn's Race to Revolution and also Citizen Coke. All donations until the top of the hour will help me meet my goal, which is, you know, I'm only $50 short, and you can call 202-588-9739 to do that. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our shows and past shows. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On The Ground Show. Now stay tuned for the news, followed by Krista Property on the Thursday edition of Don't Forget the Blues. Raise your voice. Peace.